Good morning. So, last time we talked more about branch prediction. So this idea that, well, when we have a control hazard, one thing we could do was stall until we figure out what code we're supposed to be executing next, and only then actually execute that code. But often we can make a pretty good guess about what to execute next. In particular, when we had a conditional jump, well, there's only two possibilities. We can choose one of them and just start doing it. And the only problem is if we're wrong. And sometimes we're going to be wrong, of course, because we didn't actually figure out the result of that conditional jump or whatever else caused our control hazard. But in that case, we just need to have a way of undoing it. And that sounds very tricky. And in general, it is. Like, if we had these instructions that we were guessing run all the way to completion, we'd have to like undo changes to registers and memory, and that would be pretty annoying. But in our pipeline, we found out that, oh, well, we figure out whether the guess is correct in a couple cycles, and because we have our pipeline, the instructions don't actually make it far enough to change anything important yet, because we don't actually write memory or registers or the condition codes until several stages into our instructions. So it turned out that undoing the instructions was fairly simple. We just needed to clear out pipeline registers. Then we talked about, well, how do we implement all this stalling, squashing, these things which control what's happening in our pipeline? And we had this sort of helpful tool, which was this write disable and reset signal for each of our register banks. So we could use the write disable signal to hold an instruction in a pipeline stage. Why would that work? Because we determined what instruction was in a stage by looking at the registers that were feeding the stage. So if we just keep those registers the same, rather than taking in new values, we'll keep the same instruction in that stage. We also needed the ability to put a NOP in a stage. And we needed this for squashing. That was pretty clear because we had these instructions that were going through the pipeline we wanted to get rid of. We can't actually have nothing in a pipeline stage, so we can put the values for a no-op instruction. So the stage is going to have to do something, but we'll make the something it does be something that has no effects. We also needed this for quote-unquote normal stalling, because if we're keeping an instruction in the decode stage, if we don't do anything else about it, it's also going to go on to the execute stage, and we would duplicate the instruction. So to keep us from doing that, we needed to send, when we were keeping instruction in decode, a no-op to the execute stage in place of what would normally be sent, which is that same instruction we were keeping in decode. We don't want to duplicate instructions. And we talked about, okay, so we have these signals. How do we figure out how to set them? And usually our logic's going to look at the I codes we have in our pipeline registers. So if we want to say, stall as long as this return instruction hasn't made it to the write-back stage, we can do that by seeing if there's a return instruction in decode, a return instruction in execute, and so on. And we can check that by looking at the I code values that we're passing through the pipeline registers anyway, because we need them for other control signals. So questions on these things we covered last time? So our next topic is going to be dealing with an issue we had in our processor, kind of glossed over. We had these memories, and we said that we have this data instruction memory that take one cycle per access. But if you remember the beginning of the semester, I told you, we have to talk to a memory on a different chip, and that's going to be actually much slower than one cycle. So how do we have these memories that only take one cycle? Why did we use that model if, in fact, we need to go to this external memory that's so much slower? Why were we building processors as if we had these one-cycle memories? And, well, the answer is that we can't always do it in one cycle, but we can do it in one cycle a long time, a lot of the time, by keeping copies of part of the memory in what we'll call a cache. So we'll have this small memory that can be accessed quickly. Why can it be accessed quickly? Because when we make it small enough, we can make it so we can access it faster. The reason why our big main memory can't be accessed so quickly is because it's so big and so dense, we can't build that to take one cycle. But we can build a memory of, on the range of kilobytes to take one cycle. So our solution is that we're going to keep the part of the memory we're actually using in this fast cache. So most of the time, we'll only take one cycle to access. And it might seem like, well, that's kind of a lofty goal, because, you know, if we have gigabytes of memory and we're only keeping a copy of a few kilobytes of it, aren't we usually not going to be able to use the copy? And it turns out that we're going to be able to use the copy a lot of the time. This is just something that is kind of a natural property of how programs work that's going to let us construct these caches so that happens. And so here I have a picture of a 2004 single core processor. Why from 2004? Because someone conveniently labeled the parts of the processor for me so I can figure them out, which is a little trickier on a modern multi-core processor to find. And in this processor, we have a bunch of storage. So we have the most obvious storage, which is the register. So on this processor, there's some floating point registers, which are in this area labeled the floating point unit, and some integer registers in this area labeled the execution unit. So that's our sort of main storage. That's our fastest storage. But we know our programs can't do everything with registers. So often, we're going to have to store things in bigger, slower memories. And the first bigger, slower memories this processor has are these two caches I'll call L1 caches for level one. They're the first place that our accesses to memory are going to try to go. And this processor has a separate data cache and instruction cache. And these data caches and instruction caches are what the instruction and data memory you've used in HTLRS represents. But these aren't big enough to store all our data, so sometimes they need to go to something else. And the first something else they go to on this processor is this L2 cache, which, yes, takes up half the chip. This is 1 megabyte of storage, but this was a general purpose desktop CPU. Even in 2004, we had more than a megabyte of memory. So that's not where all the storage is. And on this processor, we have this thing here labeled the DDR memory interface that goes to some external chips that have more storage. And on more modern processors, the most common design, in addition to having the second level of cache, would have a third level of cache. In a single core design in 2004, they decided that wasn't worth it, so they just have two levels. So often we have a second level cache, and then we have our main memory. And I've kind of drawn this as a pyramid because at the top we have the smallest amount of storage, but it's going to be the easiest to get to, and this kind of built on top of these bigger and bigger pieces of storage. And as we go down this pyramid, we get more and more storage, but our access times get much higher and higher. And I give it sort of a rough order of magnitude number. In practice, these will vary by like a factor of 2 or 3. So if we're accessing registers, typically that takes about a cycle, so we can do that in like less than a nanosecond. If we're accessing the L1 cache, typically that's around a nanosecond. So often that actually, in HTLRS, we have that take one cycle. Often that's a little more than one cycle, but not much. If we're accessing an L2 cache, commonly that will take around 5 nanoseconds. For chips that have an L3, often that will be on the order of 20-ish nanoseconds. And I say ish because like this can vary by like a factor of 2 or 3 in either direction. And main memory will be something like 100 nanoseconds. And our goal is going to be that when we're running our programs, we want to see memory having the speed that the L1 cache has. But obviously, that's not always going to be possible. We'll talk about how often that's possible in a bit. But what our L1 cache is going to do is that we're going to have our sort of data memory, and we're going to be able to read and write from it. And it's going to have a little extra machinery to tell us when a value is actually available, because it's going to take a variable amount of time. So when the value is actually in the L1 cache, it's going to be nice and fast. But when it's not, we're going to have to wait for it. And we're going to have, you know, one possible interface will have this ready signal, and we'll have to stall our pipeline as long as that ready signal doesn't come. And why would it not be ready immediately? Because this L1 cache sometimes, when the value is not available, is going to handle communicating to the next level of cache or eventually to main memory. So we're going to have the same kind of interface you've seen in HTLRS, but those data and instruction memory is really going to be a cache, but that cache is going to be responsible for going to the next level and the next level and so on if we need to do that. So what will have happen is our CPU is going to ask the cache for, hey, I'd like to get the value at address ABCD. I'd like to get the value at address 1234. And the cache, if it doesn't have the value, is going to ask the next level of memory or cache for the value and forward it. If it does have the value, like in this case of 1234, it's just going to send it back and it's not going to have to contact the next level. And we want that to be happening most of the time. So questions about this sort of interface that cache provides? Yes?
Just to make sure, you said that HTLRS does this for us, right? Or would we have to...
So the question is, HTLRS does this for you? So HTLRS doesn't simulate a cache, but the interface HTLRS provides is the one this cache provides. The interface you're using for data memory is like this. Other questions? I guess to be more explicit, in HTLRS, the simulated memory is like faster than is realistic. So when we're using these caches, sort of our goals are going to be, we want to have the performance of that small, fast level one cache. We want to have the capacity of the largest memory. And it seems like that we can't achieve any approximation of this intuitively, but there's actually a reason why we're going to be able to do that. And this is because we're going to make two big assumptions about the programs we run. And these assumptions I'm going to call temporal locality and spatial locality. So the assumption about temporal locality is that if I see a program accessing a value now, that value is going to be accessed again soon. So if we're accessing a memory location, I'm going to see another access to that memory location sometime in the near future. And the consequence of temporal locality is that my cache, when I access something, it should try to store that value in fast memory because I'm going to access it again later. Another property we're going to assume is spatial locality, that if a value is accessed, I'm likely to access values nearby it at addresses that are adjacent to it or otherwise close by soon. And the consequence of this for caches is that when I access a value, the cache shouldn't just load that value, it should load the things that are next to it in memory. Because if they're in their fast storage, they'll be accessed again soon and it can avoid going to the next level of memory. And, well, these are seem like bold assumptions about programs, but in fact, they're kind of natural properties, that if we just look empirically at the kind of programs people write without trying, they end up having temporal locality and spatial locality all over the place. And to give an example of that, I'm going to look at a little bit of C code here. So here, I have a C function that computes the mean of a list of doubles. So how do we do that? We have this total variable. We add up all the array elements to compute the total. Then we divide the total by our length. And this program has a ton of temporal and spatial locality. So one form of temporal and spatial locality we have is, well, if we're thinking of the machine code for this program, we have these instructions for the loop that run a whole bunch of times. Those have excellent temporal locality. If my cache sees me loading the machine code for this add here, it's really a good idea for it to keep that cache because most of the time I'm going to be reading that add instruction again. That's a great idea to cache that. We also have great spatial locality in our machine code. If the program sees me loading the machine code for this less than operation, it's probably a really good idea for it to also have the machine code for the nearby add operation loaded at the same time, because I'm going to access that again soon, most of the time. So we have excellent spatial locality throughout this code for the machine code. So the machine code has great temporal locality and great spatial locality, and it's not because I wrote this machine code specifically to have that, it's just, you know, when I naturally like programs with loops, I end up having great locality for my machine code. Great temporal and spatial locality. We also have good locality for our data. So we have three variables here. Total, I, length, that are all accessed over and over again. So these have great temporal locality. Now, if we think of how this gets compiled, the cache won't take advantage of that temporal locality probably, because the compiler will probably use registers for those. So what's happening there is that we still have temporal locality, but rather than the cache taking advantage of it, the compiler did it for us. By putting them in registers, even faster storage. But if we ran out of registers, we'd still have great temporal locality for them, or if the compiler for some reason decided not to put those values in registers, they still have great temporal locality. We also have very good spatial locality in our data because I'm accessing this values array in order. So if I see an access to values of I, I'm likely to access values of I plus 1 soon. And that means that my cache can take advantage of that by, when I access values of I, also loading some additional elements of values, rather than loading one element at a time. So you can see here that, like, this just program, just we just naturally have tons of spatial and temporal locality, and this just happens within the programs we write. Now, it's true, I could write a program where none of these are true, where there's horrible temporal and spatial locality in the code and the data, but that's just not the type of programs we run. And that's why our caches are going to be effective, you know, even though it seems like, oh, I can't store that much data. You know, I can't store a couple kilobytes of data and really speed up a program that uses a gigabyte of space. But turns out we can, and this is why. Yes?
So how do you understand
So the question is, because the total value changes, are we accessing different values? So is that your question?
No, so like, for example, if values at I, if it's like 1, 2, 3 is the values, and then it's not accessing like the sum 3, it's like just accessing sum 6.
So you're saying that...
Like partial sums, it's not accessing
those. That when we're accessing total, we're not accessing the final sum, we're accessing these partial sums? Question, it's not accessing the partial sums, so would it have temporal locality? So this plus equals operation, this is reading and writing total. This is, I would say, so this is two accesses to total, right? So we're reading total to do the plus equals operation, and then writing it to store the result of the plus equals operation. So we're accessing those partial sums all the time. And the reason I say it's temporal locality is my assumption is that we're storing total in the same place before and after, that we're not like making new storage locations. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
Is there a limit to how many variables that we can store in cache?
The question is there a limit to how many variables we can store in cache? Yes, so as we'll see, caches, we're gonna have very finite capacity. So yes, there will be a limit for these. Other questions? Yeah.
When we store, for example, like a piece of machine code in the cache, like how do we recognize that we're like accessing, for example, for the temporal locality, how do we recognize that we're accessing the same thing? Like, are they stored alongside like their original address in memory, or do we just know?
So the question is, in our cache, when we're storing something, how do we recognize, you know, that we have something stored versus not? So we're going to go into the most common set of strategies for that later. The short answer is we're going to use the memory addresses. Other questions? Okay, so let's look at building a little cache. So we're going to build a direct mapped cache. So this is one of the simplest types of caches. And my goal here is I'm going to have this big memory, and I'm going to have a small cache. And my goal is that I'm going to store part of the big memory in the small cache. And I've decided here that my cache is going to store 2, 4, 6, 8 bytes of data. And one decision I'm going to make is like, well, I could just store like 8 bytes from memory all together, but I want to be able to store multiple different things in the cache. So I'm going to divide up my cache into chunks I'm going to call blocks. And in this case, I've chosen that my blocks are going to be 2 bytes. So I didn't want to choose them to be 1 byte because I want to take advantage of spatial locality. I want to at least, you know, get some more than one value at a time. But I want to have be able to store a bunch of things. So the compromise I chose for this size was 2 bytes. In a more realistic cache, we'll choose a block size of like 64 bytes, but that wouldn't fit very well in this slide. And so I've divided up my cache into these fixed size blocks. I'm going to divide up my memory into blocks of the same size. And what I'm going to do here is I'm going to take one of these blocks of memory is going to be placed into one of these blocks of cache. So I'm always going to store one of these, you know, even to odd address sets of memory. So I'm going to store 0011 or 2233 and so on. I'm going to choose one of those to place in each of these blocks as I'm using my cache. So let's say I have this cache here and the processor asks me to read a byte at this address here, 01011. And I have this cache here and I need to figure out, oh, is that address there? And well, I need some extra information here. So one thing I don't know is like which of these 4 blocks of data could be that value. And in this design called the direct map cache, we're going to make a choice to simplify this search, that each of the blocks of the cache can only go to store certain parts of the memory. So in particular, I'm going to assign an index to each of these blocks, just 0 through 3 in this case, because we have 4 blocks. And I'm going to say that index 0 can store block 0 of the main memory, or block 4 or block 8, and so on. So basically every 4th block can go to the first slot. Every 4th block starting with block 1, not 0, can go to the second slot, and so on. So I'm just making it so there's this many-to-one mapping of something in memory where it can go in the cache. And this is going to simplify my cache lookup in hardware because I'm only going to be checking one place for a value when a processor asks for it. If you're thinking ahead, you might say, maybe this will cause problems later. Yes, we'll talk about those later. So we have this kind of mapping here where I have these indices that store particular values. And because I have a power of 2 number of blocks in my cache, it turns out that the index number here corresponds to certain bits of our addresses. And that's by design, and this happens because my block size is a power of 2, meaning the location in the block is just the last bit of the address in this case. So, you know, it's 0 for the first part of the block or 1 for the last part of the block. And since I have 4 rows in this cache, that means that I need 2 bits to determine which row it is. And that turns out to be exactly these 2 bits I have highlighted in our addresses. And this is really nice in the hardware because we're going to be able to take the address the processor gives us, and we're just going to be able to extract these 2 bits and look in that row. We don't need to do any division or any calculation like that. We just extract some bits and we're set. So I have exactly one place the block can go, but I have a little bit of a problem. I know that if I have this value cached, that it's here. Now, we, looking at the contents of memory here, know that the value I want, the block I want, is this one. And clearly 0000 isn't AABB. But we can tell that because we're checking memory, and we don't want to check memory every time. That would defeat the point of having this cache, which is supposed to be faster than checking memory. So we're going to want some extra information in the cache, some bookkeeping data, to help us remember, what did I put there? And in this case, since it's all zeros, probably what happened is I didn't put anything there. Now, I don't actually know that, because maybe there's some bytes of memory that are zeros that I have cached here. So we need some extra way of telling that. So we're going to have an extra bit of information for every row called a valid bit. And that's going to be 0 when we haven't stored anything there yet, and it's going to be 1 when we have. So this is going to help us know, did I put anything in here yet? Okay, so in this case, I check the valid bit, and I find out, well, I have 0000 where I would have this value stored, but it's not there yet. There's nothing there yet, in fact. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell the processor, hey, your value you're looking for, it's BB here. But I'm also going to load this whole block, the AABB, I'm going to copy that into the cache. So next time the processor asks for it, which I assume it will do because I believe in temporal locality, I'm going to have that available. Now there's a bit of a problem with this. So what if the processor asks for 00010, for example? I'm going to say, okay, if I look at the bits that correspond to the index, this goes to that row. That row is valid, and we're looking for the first part of the block, and I might tell the processor, oh, that's AA. But it's not. We know from looking at the memory that that value is, in fact, 22. But we don't have that block cached. So we need some way of remembering which of the possible blocks we actually put in the cache. And one way we could do that is I could write down here, I could write that, oh, this came from 01010. I could write the address I got the block from. But there's a bit of a trick we can do. So one trick we can do, there's, I guess, two tricks. So one trick we can do is we can say, well, all these blocks range from something 0 to something 1. So I don't actually need to store the 0 part. So we'll just scratch that out. Another thing we can say is, well, any block that made it to index 01, we know has a 01 in the next two bits. So I can scratch those bits out. And so I only actually need to store the 01 part, because the 01 at the beginning, because I know there must be a 01 after it, because that's how we got to that row. And I know there must be a 0 after it, because all our blocks start at something 0. Just because they're 2 bytes. And I'm in fact going to do that, so I'm going to store what we'll call a tag, which will be the bits of the address we haven't used yet. So I'm just storing only part of the address. I could store the whole address, but that's just wasteful because I know based on the organization of this cache what the other bits are, so I don't need to write them down in the cache. Questions? Yeah?
Do addresses always have 5 bits?
Question, do averages always have 5 bits? In this example, they do, but in our processors, they typically have a lot more bits. I would say 64, but that's not quite true. But.
So we just need to store like the bits like after the first key, right? Because, like,
so in this question, we just need to store the bits after the first 3. So in this cache, we need to store the bits after the first 3, because we had 1 bit to determine where in the block we were, and 2 bits to determine which row we're in. In a more realistic cache, our blocks are going to be bigger, so we're going to have more bits to determine where in the block we are. We're going to have more rows, so we're going to have more bits to determine which row we're in. But the number of bits we'll make is going to be based on the layout of the cache. Yes?
I've
So the question is, why is this faster than just going to the memory? So it's going to churn out that our accessing our cache, accessing a row of our cache, is going to be a lot faster than accessing a row of our memory. And this is going to be a physical property of our cache because our cache is just physically smaller. So accessing space in something that's physically smaller, we can just make that faster. We can make hardware that does that faster. Versus the kind of large memory that this comes from. So that's where our main advantage is going to be. And you're saying, isn't doing this tag comparison kind of expensive, right? We have to get the right row. So you have to somehow extract the row. Though that's kind of the same as what we have to do to memory. But we also have to do this tag comparison. Doesn't that take time? It does. But it's not going to be a significant amount of time compared to how much slower the big memory is. Other questions? Yeah.
Can you explain again how the indexing of the cache works to find where in the memory it's selected?
The question, can I explain how the indexing of the cache works? So because we did this sort of one-to-one assignment, so we just said that the first block of memory goes to index 0. The next one goes to index 1, and so on. So I did this goes to 0, this goes to 1, this goes to 2, this goes to 3. And there's only three indexes in the cache. Only goes 0 to 3, right? So I just went wrap around. This goes to 0, this goes to 1, this goes to 2, this goes to 3, this goes to 0, and so on. So that's how I assigned blocks of memory to indices. And when I did this, it turns out that, this counting is just counting up in these bits of the address. Why those bits? Because I stripped the bit that determines where in the block I am. Right. So we have this one bit that determines if I'm at the beginning or the end of the block for these 2-byte blocks. And I'm just counting up in those bits. And that's how we could do that efficiently. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so what our cache looks like, was actually after this, is that we're going to take an address in, and we're going to divide it up into parts. I'll give you names for these parts. We're going to call this middle part the index. The index is going to determine what row of the cache we go to. We're going to get a valid bit, a tag, and some data. We're going to take the valid bit and compare it to the part of the address we call the tag. We're going to see if they're equal and it's valid. And if so, we have what's called a cache hit, that the value is in our cache. We don't have to go to the slower memory. If it's not in our cache, we'll call that a miss. And then we're going to have to extract the part of this block the processor is asking for. So in this case, I have 4 bytes the processor could be asking me for. And I'm going to use the lower bits of the address to determine where in the block the value the processor is looking for comes from. In this case, we're looking for index 2. If we think of our block, we have 0, 1, 2, 3. So we're going to use something like a mux to return the 6. The B6 value, which is index 2. Because 1, 0 is 2 from our address. Questions? Yes?
What does the
100 represent? So that part of our address is our index. So that means we go to row 4. 100 binary is 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. So that's why I selected that row. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions?
That 100 index is not the first block we're looking for, because we have multiple blocks down there. So we need to update the tag and go to the memory again to find the
tag. So your question is, what if the tag didn't match? What would happen? That if this wasn't the block we stored there?
Yeah.
In that case, we have, instead of this being a hit, it would be a miss, and our and we'd have to know, yes, to go to the next level of cache or main memory. How does the hit work? We see if the tag is equal and it's valid.
Got it. Thank you.
Yes?
If the offset were 3, like one line, then
Question, if the offset were 3, as in 1, 1, would we get a B7? Yes. Okay, other questions? Okay, so a piece of terminology. So the things I called rows, we're going to call those sets later on. And the preview as to why we're doing that is that we're going to have a later cache design that's going to extend this direct mapped cache idea, where instead of storing one block per row, we're going to store multiple blocks per row. And we'll see why we want to do that a bit later. I'm just mentioning that because we'll use the term sets on this slide and for the rest of our talking about caches. So here, I have an address, 0, 1, 1, 1, 1. And in each of these caches, that address has the value FF that is actually stored in these caches right now. And we're going to talk about, well, splitting up the address. We saw we had to split up the address into this tag part, this index part, and this offset part. So the offset part determined where in a block we were. The index part determined what row we'd go to, and the tag part was everything left over. So your exercise is to split up our address here into tag, index, and offset for each of these three caches. So can someone give me a first step for doing this? And I would recommend starting with the offset bits, but maybe you don't want to do that. Someone, yes? Isn't the offset only 1 bit? So it depends on the block size. So it was 1 bit with the initial cache we showed because it had 2 byte blocks. But you saw in this example here, we had 4 byte blocks, so we needed 2 bits. We want to apply that to these caches. Or, yeah. So the question is, you take the log 2, your first proposal was the number of bytes in the block, that's right. And it's bytes because that's what the processor is asking for. It's asking for a particular byte. Now, often we'll read more than a byte, but we're going to specify where to read by specifying a byte to start at. So yes, it's going to be, the offset's going to be based on the number of bytes in the block, log base 2 of that. So let's go through our cache. So this has 2 byte blocks. This means we have 1 offset bit. This has 4 byte blocks. So log base 2 of 4 means we have 2 offset bits. Set. And this has 1 byte, which means we have 1 offset bit. And the offset bit is always the least significant bits of our address. So that means that our offset for these caches is going to be the 1 at the end of the address, this 1 here. For the bigger cache, for the bigger block cache, I should say, it's going to be the 1, 1 at the end of the address. Okay. So how about our index bits? Can someone tell me anything about any of the index bits? Okay, we can check how many sets we have. So do you want to start with, choose one to start with?
For the first one, we have 4 sets. It means we have 4 options for index, so we have 2 bits.
Yeah, so here for the first one, you said we have 4 sets, so we have 4 options, we need 2 bits. Yeah, so 4 sets equals 2 to the 2 sets. So we need 2 bits to determine which row we go to, and we kind of gave that away because I labeled the index as having 2 bits. So we're going to go to one of those to determine which one for this address. We're going to say, okay, here I have, I need to start where the offset ended, which was here, and I need to take 2 bits. So these 2 bits here are going to be my index. And my tag is going to be everything left over. So I have left over a 0, 0, 1. Because I have to have count for the whole address. So that's how I split up the first part. So someone want to tell me how many index bits are we going to have, well, for the 8 set cache? So someone holding up 3. And you can see that because of how I labeled the cache, that we have 3 bits here. So so our index in this case is going to be these 3 bits here. So we'll take 1, 1, 1, 1. And for a 2-set cache, we're just going to have 1 index bit. It's either 0 or 1. So for that one, we're just going to take this 1 here. That gives us 1. And then we have all our leftover bits. So in this case, for our tag, so in the case of the second row, our tag is the 0, 0 we haven't accounted for yet. In the case of the third row, the tag is the 0, 0, 1 we haven't accounted for yet. So questions on how we found the tag, index, and offset for each of these? Okay, so let's talk about a more realistic case. So let's say I have a 64 byte block, 128 set cache, so it's an 8 kilobyte cache. This is probably a more realistic size. So if my addresses are 32 bits, how many tag, index, and offset bits am I gonna have? Start with that exercise. And if you have time, go into the next part, which is how do we split up? What cupcakes are in the same block as that address? Who'd like more time for the first question? Okay, so let's start with how many offset bits. Who thinks we have 4 or fewer offset bits? 5, 6, 7, 8 or more? Okay, we have either no clue or 6 as the most common answer. That's what I get. So why 6? Because that 6 because of 2 to the 6 equals 64, and we need 6 bits to determine which of the 64 bytes in a block we're referring to. And that's going to be the least significant 6 bits of our addresses. How about index bits? Who thinks we have four or fewer index bits, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 or more, no clue. Okay, so you have consensus for 7, and that's because I have 128 rows, and I need 7 bits to determine which row. If I number the rows in binary, I'm going to need 7 bits to do that. And our tag, that's going to be 32 minus 7 plus 6. Okay, so now that we know that, let's talk about the second question. And the thing we're going to want to do here, or thing I would want to do, maybe you'll do this problem differently, is split this up into tag, index, and offset. And to do that, we'll convert to binary. Okay, who'd like some more time? No. Okay, so who thinks, and there might be multiple, we'll click, select all that apply here. So who thinks A, B, C, D, no clue? Okay, so a plurality answer is A, B, and C, and not D, which is what I get. Let's talk about why I got that. So if we think of our blocks, the way our blocks work in this cache when we assign them for memory is that they all share the same tag and index. Everything in the block shares the same tag and index, but has different offset bits because our blocks range, with the 2 bytes from 0 to 1 for that, with the 4 byte blocks from 0, 0 to 1, 1 in those lower bits, So we determine what's in a block by just varying the offset bits. So what's the range of the block that contains this address? Well, that's what we're going to get if we go from, you know, the same tag 00100000 and an offset of zeros, all zeros, to an offset of all ones. That's the block we're going to store. We always store starting with offset 0 and ending with offset all ones, because we divided up our memory into those fixed size blocks, and we never like realign those blocks. They always start at address 0. The next block is at, you know, if our block size is n, at address n, then 2n, then 3n. So they're always a multiple of the block size, which means they're always going to end, the beginning of the block is always going to end with a bunch of zeros. So the range of addresses in our blocks in binary here is this. And if I convert this back to hex, this is 0x1000 through 0x103f. I got 3f because I have, I should write this as 6-bit f here, and this is a 3. So things in that inclusive range are going to be in the same block. And that's what the block we're going to load into the cache when we access this value. And everything else, not in the block. So even though 0x1041 is closer, the way we divided things up into blocks, it's not going to be loaded together. Okay, so questions? Yeah. How many pieces of data can go in each block? This is a decision we make when we build the cache. And in this case, we decided that it's going to be 64 bytes of data.
It can be split up in any way.
Question, it can be split up in any way. So when we design the cache, we're going to choose one size for each block. Yeah, but we can choose whatever size we want. But we're not going to be able to like mix and match sizes in a single cache using this kind of design. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so now that we know about splitting up addresses, let's do a little example here. So here I have a cache with 2-byte blocks and 4 sets, and we're going to look through what happens when I do this set of accesses to it. So first thing I want to figure out is I have these addresses here. How do I split them up into my tag, index, and offset? And here I have 2-byte blocks, which means I'm going to have one offset bit, because 2 to the 1 equals 2. And I'm going to have 2 index bits, because I have 4 sets, and 2 to the 2 equals 4. So I could also figure this out with some formulas, but I can divide up my addresses like so. And I just highlighted where the offset, the index, and the tag are. And I look at my first access, and I sort of say, OK, this is index 0, 0. So those are the index bits. So I'm going to look in row 0, 0. I'm going to find out it's not valid, so that's a miss. But I'm not going to stop there, because when we have a miss, we want to load it into the cache, because we assume temporal locality and spatial locality. We assume that we're going to access this block, this value, or things nearby it soon, so we better load something. So I'm going to load the block containing this, which is 0 through 1. Into the cache, I'm going to write the tag out, so I remember where that came from, and record that as a miss. And then I have an example of spatial locality. I access address 1, and that happened to be in the same block, so I'm going to check index 0, yep. Does the tag match? All zeros matches all zeros, so it's going to be a hit, and I'm going to extract whatever value I got for memory for address 1. And that's going to be a hit. Then we're going to do this next access here to index 0, 1. I'm going to sign out that it's valid, so it's going to be a miss, and I'm going to load it. Then I access something at index 0, so it's valid. But I'm not done yet. I can't just say it's valid. There's something there, because I have to check the tag. So in this case, the tag is 0, 1, 1, 0, 0. that doesn't match 0, 0, 0, 0, so it's a miss. And I'm not done there. No, the cache, all it sees is that we're trying to access address 6.1. It doesn't know, it doesn't get to look ahead and find out we're going to access 0 again. So it's going to say, well, I assume I'm going to access 6.1 and things nearby it soon. So I'm going to load in to the cache 6.0 and 6.1. Why do I start with 6.0? Because that's the beginning of the block. I always start with offset 0. Doesn't matter, I started, did my initial access not at the beginning of the block. I always load a whole block because that's all I know how to store in this cache. I don't have the bookkeeping to store things with the different offsets at the beginning. So I store 0.0, update the tag, update the values. Then we access 6.2. That's going to be a hit. We check index 0.1. I check the tag. The tag matches. We're going to extract the 6.2 from here, and we have a hit. Then I access 0.0. And because of my unfortunate mistake with 6.1, well, not mistake, I did exactly what we were designed to do, but didn't work out this time. I'm going to look at index 0, find out that its tag does not match, even though it's valid, so that's going to be a miss, and I'm going to replace it with 0 and 1. Because we still assume locality, even though it didn't work out this time, we don't know better. And then I access 6.4, so I'm going to go to set index 1.0. It's not valid. That's going to be a miss. And I'm going to load that block, so that's 6.4 and 6.5. So questions on how I did this access pattern here? Yes?
Can you explain the first miss again?
Could I explain the first miss? You mean this one?
Yeah.
So initially, I'm looking up 0, index 0. And the first thing I do is check the valid bits. Is there anything there at all? There's not, so it must be a miss. And whenever I have a miss, no matter the reason, I always want to load the value I missed in the cache because of locality, I am assuming I'm going to access that again soon. And so we load the value in. To load the value in, we have to copy the tag here and load the corresponding bytes of the block that contains that value from memory. The question, it's only hit if there's something already there? Yes. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So let's do an exercise here. Which accesses are hits? And the difference we have here is I have 4-byte blocks. So this cache is twice as big. Who would like some more time? Okay, keep it up. Who thinks we have at least one hit? At least one. At least two hits. At least three hits. At least four hits. Okay, so we have reasonable consensus with some confusion. So I'll go through this relatively quickly. So our first access, we're going to check set index 0. It's not valid, so it's going to be a miss. I'll just write M for that. And we're going to have to insert this block. So it's going to be valid, it's going to be tag 000, and this block is going to be addresses 000000 through 000 through 11, through all ones in the offset bits. So we're going to load from here, we're going to load memory at 0x00 through 0x03. Load a bunch of bytes to the cache. 4-byte block, so we load 4 bytes. Then I'm going to look at access index 0, goes to the same place, and I'm going to check for the tag. The tag is going to match. That's great. And so we're going to have a hit. And in fact, we're going to be able to extract the value from the second byte with index 1 of the block. Then I access 6.3. So to access 6.3, I'm going to look at the index. The index is 0. It's valid. I'm going to check the tag. The tag is not going to match. So that means it's a miss. But we don't just stop there. When we have a miss, we're going to need to load a new value into this block. So we're going to copy our tag, 0110, and we're going to load from 011000 to all the possible offset bits. So from that, from 00 to 11, or this is from 0x60 through 0x63. If I convert that for binary back to x. So we're going to have memory at 0x60 through 63 inclusive. Then I access 6.1, so I look at index 0, I check the tag, and this time it matches because I just put that in there, so that's a hit. And the same thing is true of our next access. We have 6.2, index 0, I check the tag there, yes. Then I access 0, I'll do a different color, so 0 here. I find out it's index 0, it's valid, but the tag does not match. So I'm going to replace this again. It's going to be a miss. And we're going to insert, again, memory at 0 through 3. Then I access 6.4. That goes to index 1. Index 1 is not valid, so that's going to be a miss, and I'm going to end up loading in the block containing 6.4, which is going to be 6.4 through 6.7. So questions on how I figured this out? so let's look at a little bit of interlude of talking about hash practices in actual C code. So here I have a function in C and its corresponding assembly. My question is, what data cache accesses does it do? It also does instruction cache accesses. We're going to be talking less about those because you typically have less control over them as a programmer, but worth knowing data cache accesses. What data cache accesses happen in this code? And one of them is easy, one of them is tricky. There's two. At least two. So these are things that would use the data memory in your HCL assignments. Someone tell me one of the data cache accesses that happens. Yeah? Scale factor. So scale factor, this is a global variable in memory. So this is a memory access. So we have scale factor. That's a read. There's one more. Yeah. For RET. What do we do? What's the access for RET? So the return address. Yeah. So those are two data cache accesses. So let's say I was losing this in a loop, like so. In this case, we'd really care about those data cache accesses being hits, right? We'd really want every time it's a hit. So it'd be really bad if we did this big loop and went to memory ever inside of this fast cache. So let's say we're calling this thing in a loop, and these are our two addresses. The return address ends up at this location on the stack, this just particular random address, and our scale factor is located in our global variables region at this address. This seems nice for the cache. We should be able to cache these two unrelated addresses. And, well, sure, we just, let's say I have a 32 kilobyte direct map cache, 64 byte blocks. Those are kind of realistic sizes. And I divide it up into tag, index, and offset. These are the numbers I get. I got a tag, two different tags, and I just happen to get the same index. So these two apparently unrelated addresses would just happen to conflict. Now, you might say, wait a moment, you constructed this example to have this happen, and yes, I did. But this sort of thing does happen kind of by accident sometimes. That we just had bad luck getting the same index for unrelated values. So we're going to talk about an extension next to our direct map cache design that's going to avoid this problem. And you can see why this could happen by accident, because, well, you know, sometimes these two regions of memory are just going to have bits in common. And in that case, suddenly our program is way slower. That's really annoying. And you might say, well, does this happen in reality? So one way we can look at that is by sort of simulating what cache performance would happen. So in a future assignment, we're going to be using a cache simulator. And I ran a program that did a bunch of binary search tree lookups in a cache simulator, simulating a direct map cache. And with a direct map cache, what happened? Well, this pink line here represents the amount of stuff the cache can store versus on the x-axis is plotted how much space the binary search tree takes up. So if the cache was working ideally, if we didn't have these sort of random coincidences, we'd expect that as long as our binary search tree fit in the size our cache could store, that we'd have very few misses. But what actually happens is that we have this small number of misses before we get to that size. And it turns out, when I look at trying other cache designs, that I can get this number of misses down much closer to zero if I just deal with those coincidences in a better way. I don't have them just conflict with each other. And you can see actually that this is running on my real cache, which implements the strategy that it does much better at those small sizes. And another thing this phenomenon does is that when we're dealing with cases where we're like going down things that happen to be a power of 2 bytes away, we get these extraordinary number of phases. So this is another simulation, this time of matrix multiply, which we'll talk about a bunch as a running example probably next week or the week after. And you can see here, I have this crazy number of misses when I get to the size 64 by 64. And that's not an outlier. This is a simulation. That's an exact measurement. What's happening there is, well, 64 is a power of 2. When I go down a column, I'm adding 64 times something to an address, and the index bits stay the same. So as I'm going down a column, everything's mapping to the same set of the cache. So I get this horrible miss rate. And we don't like these things happening. So we're going to be talking about next week about adding something we'll call associativity. And kind of the preview is that we're just going to add an extra block to each set, or more than one extra block, so we can avoid these coincidences, making it so we just can't store two different things that just coincidentally match an index. So that's going to be our topic next week.